today, Barry Aviation versus Land O'Lakes Municipal Airport Commission. We'll just take a second to let the crowd disperse. Mr. McIntyre, you can begin.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Robert McIntyre. I represent Barry Aviation. And I must say I have been spellbound by the prior case. Commercial lawyers such as myself seldom encounter these constitutional issues. And I was very pleased to be here today. We're here in a very simple case. And I have the pleasure of presenting a very narrow argument in Barry. There were no depositions taken in this case. There was no paper discovery. There was no trial. There was no summary judgment. There weren't even any Rule 26 disclosures. Right out of the box, the district court decided that the claims brought by the plaintiff appellant fell outside of the applicable statute of limitations. Now, there's a great deal of rhetoric, verbiage, and case law in everyone's briefs regarding the sufficiency of both the federal claims and the state law claims on a merits basis. However, the court, in fact, did not address a single one of those. The case from the court below is summarized on page 1617 of the order that says, "In this case, I will dismiss plaintiff's federal claims without leave to amend, because even construing all well-pleaded facts as true, in drawing all inferences in favor of the plaintiff, I am persuaded the plaintiff's RICO and Section 1983 claims have been brought outside the applicable statute of limitations." This was the fundamental error committed by the court below, because the first threshold issue that a district court must address is not a decision between competing sets of facts, but whether or not facts exist upon which to base a controversy. And that is initially set forth in the Butcher case, which is quoted in the briefs.
Now, of course,
yes, ma'am.
Forgive me, but once the defendant put the blame on Barry Aviation for the low number of airport operations, wasn't the plaintiff on notice to investigate further? I mean, presumably the plaintiff knew it wasn't the cause of the fivefold precipitous drop as early as 1993.
Let me address that, Your Honor. And it's clear that the court is fairly well versed with the facts, so I won't go into them in any great repetitive detail. Barry Aviation was not from Land O'Lakes. Mr. and Mrs. Barry, who own Barry Aviation, were not from this area. They were vacation visitors, and they happened to be owners of an airplane. They wanted to get into the aviation business. They investigated several opportunities in northern Wisconsin to put in a fixed base operation. They came to Land O'Lakes. At an official meeting of the government of the town of Land O'Lakes, they were given an official government document. This official government document was an application to the Department of Transportation, the state of Wisconsin, the Federal Aviation Administration, for money to expand the airport to accommodate additional operations, to serve more customers. Included in that document was another official federal government document, which was based on information provided by the government of the town of Land O'Lakes and its airport manager, Mr. Kircher, which certified the number of operations at this airport. Based on the tender of these official government documents, which turned out to be patently false, Mr. Berry and Mrs. Berry established their business in Land O'Lakes. Now, there was no fixed base operation there before upon which to base any historical data. They weren't buying a going restaurant or a going business. They were starting a greenfields based on the representations of the town in its official government documents.
See, the bottom line question, though, is wasn't the plaintiff aware that the number of operations at the airport was significantly different from the number that had been represented? And weren't they aware of that almost as soon as the ink was dry on the contract?
No, Your Honor, they weren't, because while it wasn't traffic at the level they expected, it was attributed by the town government in inquiry to other factors. There was construction at the airport, there was a shutdown of the runway, there was a problem with the fuel system. The government people in the town indicated to Berry that the fault that he had no business was due to people going to other airports, Eagle River, Iron Mountain, and other places.
But isn't that irrelevant? Isn't what's relevant was when the plaintiff realizes that there's a significant difference here in what was represented?
The plaintiff certainly suspected. This is the issue, Your Honor, and I can see where you're going. But the problem we have here is certainly the plaintiff sees some difference. But what the plaintiff doesn't know is that he is relying on official government documents that were shown to him, documents that were given to the government for the purposes of obtaining funds for airport expansion based on operation. He made the mistake of believing his public contract partners. And he relied on these official documents. It's something from the FAA submission signed by the town, a petition for funding that certifies operations. So Mr. and Mrs. Berry shovel money into this business, literally. They eventually moved up there after 1999 and lived in the Wisconsin winter. That's how dedicated they were. In 1999, he made additional inquiries with the town, and the town gave him another official government document. This second official government document was the 1997 petition by the town for more money to expand the airport based on operations. The town said to Mr. Berry, here's our official government funding documents where we are certifying that we have these operations. The fact that these people aren't patronizing your business is your fault. You are a bad operator. Your gas prices are too high. You're not attracting the right kind of people. You're from down south. The people up here don't like you. They gave him all sorts of excuses. And Mr. Berry, being a very honest man, soldiered on because he believed that the official government documents that he was given could be relied on. And they were given to him in the context of establishing and maintaining a public contract. This is no different than a contract for building a fire station, a school, a highway, or a bridge. He relied on the official government documents that were given to him. After the 1999 proffer, which is, interestingly enough, in the defendant's index, Mr. Berry reached his breaking point. And in the course of ordinary business, he found in the basement of the airport terminal building, not in the official town records, where he could have supposedly gone and conducted due diligence in the underlying records of the town, a file cabinet that were full of the actual airplane counts. Now, the line of cases said if you exercise due diligence or you don't exercise due diligence and the information is there, that's your baby. That's Midwest Machine versus Spitz. That's McCool versus Farda.
My case, Mr.
Where in Midwest, the shareholders who bought the company could have looked at the books. They were right there. In this case, the town gave Mr. Berry the books, and they were cooked. In the Sparta case in McCool, McCool found out by accident that the share statements on their oil wells had been fabricated and redacted. The court said in McCool, you could have found out if you'd made appropriate inquiry. However, the real case here, in the law that I think this court should look at, is Chicago Heights versus LeBue. And what I like about LeBue is it's another public corruption case. In this case, Mr. LeBue, and his co-defendants took over the government of the city of Chicago Heights and engaged in corruption in public contracting. The court said in LeBue, because the defendants controlled the information and provided false information to the plaintiffs, the date of discovery is equitably told until the plaintiff actually found out the harm. And that's the doctrine here, is the doctrine of equitable tolling is set forth in LeBue. And the defendants cannot hide behind Barry's need to look up in the sky and count airplanes when they're giving him official government documents in the course of public contracting and maintaining a public contract that they know are fundamentally and patently fabricated and false, and that they concealed the core records. If the core records had been sitting in the town hall along with the records Mr. Berry was given, I don't think I'd be here. But they weren't. They kept them in a locked room in a basement in a building that Berry did not operate in.
Mr. McNair?
Yes.
I just wanted to point out the time.
Yeah, I saw the red light. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. McNair. Mr. Graham.
May it please the court, D.G. Graff, I represent the appellees in this case. The issue in this case is whether the denial of leave to amend the complaint was an abuse of the district court's discretion. If the district court made a reasonable application of the law to the facts as alleged in the complaint, and I have to point out to the court that a great deal of what Mr. McIntyre told you about this case I think is not a fair inference from the complaint and certainly would be contested if the case were tried. But if we look at the complaint that the district court had before it, an 18-page, 72-paragraph complaint, the district court considered not only the facts of that complaint that helped the plaintiff, but also the facts in that complaint that defeat the plaintiff's claim. But the district court did not dismiss this case on the statute of limitations. The district court denied the right to amend on the statute of limitations. The district court's opinion examined the 9B issues as to all the federal claims. It examined the sufficiency of the facts to establish a RICO cause of action. It established the sufficiency of the facts to establish a 1983 substantive due process case, and determined that the complaint did not allege enough facts to pass either test under 9B or 12B6. So at that point, the court exercised its discretion and dismissed without leave to amend the complaint because there was no way to save the complaint, as the district court determined, because of the statute of limitations. And the statute of limitations issue, as on the facts alleged in the complaint, are that the plaintiff was injured on June 15, 1993, when it entered into a contract on which it was misled and defrauded to get into. The plaintiff was the fixed base operator of this little airport. It did everything. It sold the gas, it ran the hangars, it leased the airplanes, It took care of everything at this airport. It was in the perfect position to know whether there was a material difference between the volume of traffic as represented before the contract and the real volume of traffic. And in the complaint, the plaintiff alleged that immediately in 1993, it noticed a significant and substantial difference between the representations that had been made and the real facts.
But the defendants, according to the complaint, hid the true numbers and blamed the plaintiffs for the low number of airport operations. And so the plaintiff doesn't know until 2000 that the numbers had never been as large as represented. Right?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because the complaint does not allege that the plaintiff discovered their injury in 2000. It alleges they discovered a file cabinet.
It would be as if
they were in an intersection accident and had the green light, didn't do anything until the statute ran, and then years after the statute ran, came back and said, I just discovered an eyewitness. So now I want to bring my claim. The plaintiff knew it was hurt back in 1993. It is not alleged that it, in fact, didn't discover the existence of that injury. It is only alleged that it discovered better evidence of that injury in 2000.
Well, of course, that's the fraudulent concealment argument, right?
That's the fraudulent concealment argument, but to rely on that, the plaintiff has to show due diligence in trying to determine whether it had a case or not, and inability to make that determination because of fraudulent concealment by the defendant. And that's not alleged in this complaint, nor is it that a fair inference from this complaint, because there's absolutely no due diligence. They allege that they became aware of substantial differences between the volume of traffic as alleged and as actually occurred.
Was there active concealment here, though, by the municipality?
I don't believe that's alleged in the complaint, Your Honor. I don't want to go too far outside the bounds of the complaint, but I don't think that's a fair inference from it. These materials in the file cabinet were logs, as are described in the complaint, and those are guest books that you sign sometimes when you go to an airport. Sometimes you don't, but they have alleged that those are vitally important, and so I guess we have to accept that within the allegations of the complaint. The issue, I think, in this case is, you know, does the discovery rule apply based on the facts of the complaint? It seems to me that the district court properly ruled that the plaintiff pled too much here. The plaintiff pled itself out of court by saying between 1993 and 2000, we knew these numbers were wrong. And on that basis, the district court correctly exercised its discretion, and I believe it should be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Graff. Max, sir, you may have 1 minute for rebuttal.
I'll try and give the short version, Your Honor. I don't think the defendant's arguments are persuasive. They are saying, in so many words, we lied. They didn't say that those official government documents weren't false. They said, we lied to the Berries. We gave them phony documents to induce them into a public contract. And when the contract didn't bear the fruits that Berry expected, and even though he asked us what was wrong and we lied to him, and even though he asked us again and we gave him another set of fraudulent official government documents, he should have looked up into the skies and known better. And therefore, he shouldn't be allowed to bring his claim. The mere fact in the complaint that Berry pled that the result of his operations were inconsistent with the representations does not bar him from recovery if there's active concealment. This is a fundamental case of fraud in government contracting, where people who knew lied on two levels. They lied to the FAA for the master airport records. Then they took the master airport records and they put them in their application for DOT and they signed it. One swore to it and the other lied about it. And they should be severely penalized.
Thank you, Mr. McIntyre. Thank you, Mr. Kraft. Case is taken under advisement.